What is up, everyone? Welcome to a special episode of the FanCast. We are live at the 2013 Toronto International Film Festival. My name is Eric Davis. I am with, of course, Sean O'Connell. We are in the same place this time. And Sean, it's day two of the festival. We've already seen four big films that are coming to theaters in like the next few months. One of them is coming in the next couple of weeks. We're going to talk about them. We're going to let you know what we thought. The first one we're going to talk about, since we just got out of it, is Jason Reitman's latest film. It's called Labor Day. It stars Josh Brolin and Kate Winslet. And it comes out, I think, in December-ish, around the holidays. It'll probably come out in limited release, maybe expand in January. A lot of people are buzzing about it, looking forward to it. Let's get your immediate thoughts on it.
It's so hard to just give a reaction to it, because we were both talking about the fact that it says a lot underneath the surface of this story. The story itself, if you just sort of spelled it out for somebody, it sounds strange. It's set in 1987 in a small town in New England. I'm guessing it was New England. Did they ever really say?
They never really said where it is, but it is 80s, small town, that kind of vibe.
And Kate Winslet plays a mom who is, she's separated from her husband, but she has custody of her son. And the son is kind of overcompensating for the loss of a father figure, a loss of a husband in his mother's life. And they meet a man, played by Josh Brolin, who I don't think, we can spoil what his identity is, can't we?
Yeah, I think it says it in the synopsis. He's okay. he meets them in a marketplace, and he's bruised and he's limping, and he's obviously on the run from something, and he kind of says, "Look, I'm going with you, and you're taking me to your house," and he kind of convinces them to be his hostages.
Right. Yes. And so it's the kind of story where you can nitpick details, but if you do that, you're overlooking this much bigger picture of what Reitman, I think, is trying to say. He's adapting a novel, a popular novel. I would imagine a lot of this subtext is in the novel and probably plays better on the page, but there's all of this emotion about the importance of a father figure in the family. The young boy in the film, does not have the influence of a man in his life. His father's absent, and so he's trying to figure out how to do simple things like play baseball or how to cook. And Josh Brolin's character sort of teaches him all these things, and he connects with the mom. And there's these discussions about the importance of just having a human touch in your life. And, you know, all those things sort of resonated with me. It was an odd story to convey those emotions, but I thought they did a really good job of conveying the emotions.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what it plays. That's the strengths of the film, is the emotions. I was tearing up as the film ended. It definitely got to me. And I kind of think that's the point of the film, is they talk about a lot of these sort of growing up and of things you have to do as you grow up and as you become adult, and what people expect you to do. And there's a really great scene where they talk about sex and the act of sex. And this is going to factor into a later, another movies that we talk about, in this podcast, but you know, that Kate Winslet at one point tells her son that you know, they talk about sex in school, and I learned what it's about, but she says they never talk about how it feels. And I can't think this is the kind of movie that you want to feel, and you don't want to nitpick, and you don't want to overthink. You want to just feel it. And when I left the theater, I was feeling the hell out of this movie.
Right, but with Reitman's films prior to this, he often goes for those emotions, but he also mixes in humor. Up in the Air is a funny movie. Juno's a very funny movie. Lighter. Young Adult had funny moments, but even though they had people like Patton Oswalt in it, he played against type, and Charlize Theron was an evil person. This is more in that direction. This is a progression of that conversation. This is Jason Reitman letting you know that he's trying to take mature steps as a storyteller, and I think he's finding his way. I'm really interested to see what he does next, but I loved this picture for the emotional components that he brought to it. And I don't know if we've seen to this level, you know, that type of storytelling in his other films.
I haven't felt this way,
right,
this emotional after a Jason Reitman movie. Yeah. I feel like he really, this was a departure for him. It's a mature, very mature movie for him. And I haven't, you know, he did it. He was able to evoke emotions that I haven't felt in previous Jason Reitman movies, and I really enjoyed it.
All right, so the festival started officially last night with Bill Condon's new movie, The Fifth Estate, which stars Benedict Cumberbatch as Julian Assange, who is the founder or co-founder, depending on whose side of the story you believe, of the WikiLeaks website. And you know, it's getting mixed reactions. It's going to get mixed reactions from me. I think that the story is kind of muddy, the way that Condon tells it. I don't know if people wanted it to be the social network for the WikiLeaks site in the way that Fincher's story put Facebook on a different pedestal and sort of told how that story came about. There's too much story. There's so much story to tell with WikiLeaks, and when you pick and choose some of the accomplishments and the victories that the website has had over the course of its short existence, it's hard to sort of break it down. For people who don't know, it's a website that protects whistleblowers through all of this code. So if you come with a corporate whistleblower or a political whistleblower and you want to expose something bad that's going on either at your Swiss bank or in the government that it eventually comes around to, Assange gives you a safe haven. He lets you, but he always says he's going to publish what you give him unedited, and eventually comes around to when he starts getting these documents from the U.S. government, it could potentially put U.S. sources in the military at risk.
Now, here's my question. I did not see the Fifth Estate, so I'm going to ask you questions about this. Is it for people who hear WikiLeaks and they're sort of following the news and they're hearing about all these things and these leaks and different people are leaking things to, you know, and they're in trouble for it, but they don't really understand it. Like, they don't. Is this accessible? Does this explain exactly what that whole story is, and in layman's terms, or do you have to have a deep familiarity with WikiLeaks in order to really get this film?
It explains it, but not well enough that I felt like I have a full grasp of what happened. I definitely understand it better, and I understand the intricacies of the site. I don't know a lot about Assange still after this movie, and he's a bit of a mystery in real life anyway, so I think that they play him as this sort of enigma, but I wanted to know more about him. I wanted to know more about the reasons why he started this site. I mean, he has a couple of speeches about why he wants to help the common man and give them this outlet to combat, you know, to have transparency in the government and the corporations. But that's sort of what I'm saying is there's just too much story to tell in a two-hour frame. And so I don't have as well of a comprehension as I wish I did at the end of the movie.
Yeah, see, I think that's the problem sometimes when you make these films about these real-life personalities, but you don't really know these real-life personalities that well, at least at this point. Maybe 20 years down the line after he's already written his autobiography and people have sat down with him for hours and hours and, you know, and they really kind of get a sense of who he is and what's going on in his brain. But to kind of, you know, piece together this film now, it kind of, from what the sense I'm getting is, it seems like it was pieced together fast to capitalize on a hot story without fully understanding who this man is before piecing that together.
Right. HBO at some point will hopefully do like a 10-part documentary on WikiLeaks. And you could, honestly. There's that much material, and each of these major accomplishments that the site has broken. Like, it took down a $1 billion corrupt Swiss bank. It shared the identities of some of the British Parliament members who were trying to work covertly. Each of those could be their own little segment, and by trying to cram them into the first half of this movie before it eventually focuses on the U.S. war papers and some major leaks that he dumped in terms of our government, that's the whole second half of the movie. It's really difficult to tell it in a two-hour frame.
The Fifth Estate comes out in theaters on October 18th. Let's move on. Blue is the Warmest Color. This is a film that won, right? The Cannes Film, the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a movie that a lot of people are talking about. You may have heard 3-hour lesbian romance drama. Maybe you've heard people describe it like that. Maybe you've heard about the illicit sexual scenes in it. A lot of people are focusing on that. But I mean, this is a film I really, really liked, and I think you did too.
I really did, and I was not prepared still. As much as I read about the graphic nature of the relationship, I was not prepared. I think it's coming into theaters with an NC-17. It earns it. But the graphic scenes between these two girls...
They need to be there.
They absolutely need to be there, and they have to be as passionate and as graphic as they are, because it really is. It's a story about... falling in love, completely in love for the first time. And for this high school girl, she passes a stranger, essentially, and their eyes meet, and it's love at first sight. But they eventually meet, they eventually talk, they eventually get to know each other, and they just are immersed in their love for each other. And so when you get to these scenes of them together, these physical scenes, you're plunged into their relationship. You're plunged into the romance that they feel between each other. But that's not the whole movie at all. There's plenty more going on in terms of how their relationship develops and how it changes and the impact that it has on each of them. The two performers, the two leads, the girls in it are tremendous. The movie took me to so many different places that I wasn't aware of because it covers several years in their relationship, and I wasn't prepared for that. It starts with the one main girl in high school, and by the time the movie's over, she's been teaching in an elementary school for several years, dealing with the after effects of this relationship. It's extremely moving. I mean, it's going to get a lot of attention for being very graphic and very physical, but it's incredibly moving.
Yeah, it is incredibly moving, and I think the translation of it, you know, it's called Blue is the Warmest Color, that's what it's coming out here, but it's actually chapters one and chapter two. Chapter one and chapter two, and it's basically chapter one and chapter two of this girl's life, and what it's like to, you know, her first couple of romances, and this is her first sort of the love of her life, or at least how it starts. And yeah, I mean, it is going to get a lot of attention, and the sex is very graphic, so you be prepared for that. But it is just, you know, we were discussing before, did it need to be 3 hours? Does a romance drama need to be 3 hours in order to kind of tell your story? And you made a good point of saying that because it's that long, you really sort of move in with these characters and this their subsequent experiences in their relationship are a little bit more powerful because of the length of the film.
Well, and there's a scene that we both talked about that occurs near the end of the film, and I can't tell you what happens in it, but it's a conversation between the two women at a certain point in their relationship, and it's gut-wrenching, and it's one of the last scenes in the movie, and it carries such of an impact because we've spent so much time with them. And I think if they'd tried to shorten it and do that same scene in a two-hour movie, it wouldn't resonate quite as strong because you just wouldn't understand the characters. And part of it's performance and part of it's just the way that the movie is structured. But when you got to that scene, it worked so much better than I thought it was going to work.
Yeah, and one of the things I loved about it is the director, I mean, is in the faces. He shoots it very up close. He's up close and personal on their faces constantly, like zooming in. And, I mean, just really close to these characters, and it kind of pulls you closer to them as well. A lot of focus on her lips, on her hair. Her hair is its own character in this film, and it's just really, really, really strong, really powerful. I think to talk Oscar, I think this film has some pretty high chances.
I would hope for at least the main lead actress, whose name I don't know because I can't really pronounce it, and I'm not going to try it on a podcast. I think what works really about the two girls is that they're not like movie star pretty. You know, they're not magazine cover girls. They're beautiful girls, but they're natural. They're very natural, and I think that lends an element to the story it's a beautiful film. It is
a beautiful film, and we strongly recommend seeing it. Blue is the Warmest Color hits theaters possibly in limited release on October 25th, but really keep an eye on it. It's a film that a lot of people are really high on. They were high on it at Cannes. They're really high on it here, and It's something to see. If you're someone who likes romance and romance movies, it's really hits a lot of emotions. I really liked it. The last film, speaking of emotions, we both have kids, so this is a tough film to watch. Prisoners, and this out of all four films that we're talking about today, Prisoners hits theaters literally September 20th, a couple weeks from now. Stars Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal. Basically, Hugh Jackman and his daughter and Terrence Howard, they're friends. They spend Thanksgiving together, the two couples, and they have kids. And the two daughters, they have young daughters, and they run off to play, and they're taken, and they're kidnapped. And it's sort of what follows. And Jake Gyllenhaal plays a detective assigned to the case, and Hugh Jackman is sort of like a man's man. He's a survivalist, and he kind of takes matters into his own hands when they're not finding their daughters. It was a very intense, emotionally driven film. It's funny, when I wrote about this on movies.com, I said a lot of people throw around the term edge of your seat a lot, you know, for any thrillers. It's an edge of your seat thriller. But you know what? Literally, my theater was on the edge of their seats for the last sequence of this film. And for other sequences in this film, it really, really delivers on that promise of keeping you on literally on the edge of your seat. What did you think?
I think that I keep describing it as like meat and potatoes. I mean, it's just a police procedural. But every once in a while, a director comes along who treats the material seriously, who gets the right cast, who brings someone special along, like cinematographer.
Roger Deakins, the guy's amazing. He did Skyfall as his most recent film. But yeah, I think if you're talking about the stars of this film, it's Hugh Jackman,
right,
who's really good in it, and Roger Deakins, because it's just shot magnificently.
But I came out of that movie comparing it to some top-notch films like Zodiac. You brought up Seven. You're not out of the ballpark with that. I thought about Ransom, Ron Howard's movie that he did with Mel Gibson.
Give me back my son!
Exactly, because it doesn't go for peaks and valleys. It just sustains its momentum over the course of its 2.5-hour run. And with about 30 minutes left to go, I turned to a friend of mine and I said, I have no idea where this is going to go. And that's very rare in a movie. You can usually telegraph like what's going to happen next. And I was not sure how far this movie was going to go. I thought Hugh Jackman gave his career best performance. He really surprised me with all the dark places he was able to go. And it made sense in the context of the story. He plays a father who there's a suspect played by Paul Dano. He's cleared, essentially, by the police, but Hugh Jackman cannot accept the fact that this kid doesn't know something and that he's just not talking. And he's going to try and get information out of this kid in any way that he can. And it's so funny, your allegiances shift as the story goes on. I supported Jackman for a little while. Then I started to think he was going too far, and then I supported the policeman. Then I felt bad for the kid, and I was all over the place.
It's the kind of film, and I remember saying this when I wrote it up, it makes you think about the way you root for a character. And because, your allegiances to characters switch throughout the film, and it's credit to the script for this is a 2.5-hour movie.
It is.
This isn't a 90-minute movie. This is a 2.5-hour movie that just really keeps kind of switching it up and changing it up. And when you think you know what's going to happen, it changes it. When you think now we're 2 hours in, we think, okay, they've laid the groundwork. We know how it's going to end. No, you don't know how it's going to end. And they just really do a tremendous job. And I like how it kind of the film really plays around with its title, Prisoners. And every single character in this film is a prisoner of some sort, either psychologically, either physically, sometimes both. And it's just it's really interesting in the way when you ask yourself, how far would you go to protect your family? And you think about that, how you answer that question now, and think about how you answer that question after you see this film.
Well, so far we've seen some strong films, and we're just scratching the surface. We have so many other good films coming up that we hope to podcast about once we're able to see them. I'm going to see the Dallas Buyers Club. Eric's going to go see 12 Years a Slave. We're definitely going to meet up to see Gravity. What else is on our radar?
Rush. I'm going to see Rush this afternoon. This is the Ron Howard racing movie with Chris Hemsworth. So I think the next podcast that we're going to do, we'll probably cover those movies. We'll do Dallas Buyers Club, 12 Years a Slave, Gravity, and Rush are another four major movies coming out, some of which have Oscar potential. And I mean, so far I'm really liking what I'm seeing.
This is your first trip to Toronto. How do you like the festival so far? And
yeah, this is my first trip to Toronto, and I like it. What I'm loving about it is the theaters are just gorgeous. They're clean. Everybody is on the ball here. You know, in terms of day one at other festivals, that there's kind of chaotic, but here everybody's on point. It feels like there's a volunteer for everybody, every festival goer, and. Toronto is a beautiful city, and it's a really it's a nice festival to kind of be at.
And it's so funny, like, we're barely scratching the surface of the types of movies that are being shown. We're not doing any of the red carpet stuff. We're not doing any of the really foreign films, independent films, documentary films. There's so much to do here, and I feel like we would need a month to cover everything.
We would need a month. Unfortunately, we only have like 15 to 20 minutes. Sean O'Connell, thank you very much. We are here, I think, until Tuesday, and so we're going to probably do one or maybe more, another couple of podcasts for you, those interested in hearing more about the films, and definitely drop comments and let us know. If you're looking at the Toronto schedule and you're saying, hey, there's a film, I really want to see what these guys think, let us know, and we'll let you know what we think, because we're running around and we're making our schedules, I think, by the hour we're making schedules, trying to figure out and fit everything in. But thank you very much, Sean O'Connell.
Thanks, Eric, so much. I appreciate you guys listening, and we will be back soon from Toronto.